Hello. I'm here to tell you about a very special activity, a one-of-a-kind activity for Pesca Plus subscribers. We are having a book club. The first book in our book club is called Hope for Cynics, The Surprising Science of Human Goodness. It's by Jamil Zaki, who's been on the show, and he will be there at the book club, but it is only for Pesca Plus subscribers. The date is February 18th. The time is 8 to 9:30 Eastern Time. And if you go to subscribe.mikepesca.com, you can subscribe for an ad-free version if you want, or go all the way to Pesca Plus and be invited to our first ever book club. There's a lot of other fantastic activities that we have for our Pesca Plus subscribers. To find out more information about all of this, sign up for our newsletter. It will all be coming out about our February 18th inaugural book club, Hope for Cynics with Jamil Zaki. It's Monday, February 3rd, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Tariff talk. One's on China, still 10%. One's on Mexico. They were suspended, but it looked like the ones on Canada were going forward. Donald Trump really wanted to tariff Canada until he pulled back. It turns out the tough tariff talk was addressed by Trudeau. But why? Why does Donald Trump want to tariff Canada? I have a theory. Donald Trump hates Canada. Not just Canada, but what Canada represents. A country led by a liberal leader. A truly democratic government. He doesn't like them. Hates Trudeau. Trudeau was mean to him. It's personal, but it's also impersonal. I would also say that Donald Trump probably hates most of the Canadian people, or would if he knew their views on things like healthcare. So long as he thinks of the Canadian people, it's not in a good way. Donald Trump also probably hates Keir Starmer. I know Elon Musk hates Keir Starmer, or at least very anti-Labor Party, and anti-Labor parties are their equivalent throughout the world. Donald Trump and his crew just doesn't like these people. He doesn't like most of the G7 leaders. He doesn't like the non-rightist leaders of European countries. Those people all liked Obama. They represent the progressive worldview. They represent progressive values. Trump thinks they look down on him, and guess what? They probably do. Now, the actual stated reason for the tariffs on Canada was the fentanyl seized at America's northern border. And it was last year 43 pounds. This is from a chart from an organization called Harm Reduction Ohio. Now, they say 700 micrograms of fentanyl, probably enough to kill you. 1,000, definitely enough to kill you. But what is a microgram? As the name quite clearly implies, it is a thousandth of a gram. I mean, you do the math, and yeah, even 4 to 3 pounds of fentanyl is enough to kill every American who did indeed die of a fentanyl overdose, which was about 75,000 Americans. But what then do you make of the 21,000 pounds seized at the southern border, which is now having only a 10% tariff? So it's not about any actual micrograms or calculations. It's about the fact that Donald Trump hates Trudeau, hates Canadians, and what he is about is about this. It's about media coverage, grudges, getting praise and credit from his base. This is what drives Trump, not anything that could you try to figure out about Canada. He definitely has some sort of hatred for Canada, probably also has some sort of hatred for Denmark, the most Canadian of the Nordic countries, I think. So this all leads me to say he will probably be making a bid to acquire Prince Edward Island. I look forward to the muscles. It's loopy, it's pointless, and I think it's going to take up our attention for quite a while. On the show today, I shall spiel about DEI and anti-DEI efforts going way too far. But first, you know, Israel bombed the chemical weapon deposits in Syria, thus, I guess, eliminating them. But when the United States was tasked with doing this, it wasn't so easy. In fact, General Jay Santee, Major General of the Air Force, led a painstaking, and I think I used this word in our interview, a painstaking process to neutralize the chemical weapons. How'd he do it? What were the steps? What was the bleach solution? We get into it all. General J.G. Santee on eliminating Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons stockpile, or at least the amount they eliminated before he kept some and made a few new bombs. The government of Syria has fallen, and with it, the chemical weapons that Bashar al-Assad held. The Israeli Air Force, soon after the fall of that government, conducted airstrikes against dozens of Syrian military bases and arms depots and facilities that were part of Syria's chemical weapons program. About a dozen years prior to this, the United States was involved in a more sanctioned and organized effort to rid Bashar al-Assad of at least some of his chemical weapons. It's serious work. It's exacting work. And the man who was essentially tasked with this work joins me now. He's retired Major General Jay Santee, and he was the Deputy Director of the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. General Santee, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me on here to tell what I think is an important story and one that was largely overlooked at the time, but what probably saved millions of lives and maybe even continues to this day to save a lot of lives because of all the chemical weapons we were able to destroy.
So take us back to, I think it was 2012 where the diplomacy took place. 2014 was about when the weapons were actually destroyed. And we're talking about 1,300 tons. Remember, a ton is 2,000 pounds. So this means 3 million pounds of chemical weapons. Obviously, this will fall to you guys, but the question of how must linger in the air. How'd you decide to tackle that question?
There was a chemical weapons convention that was formed in the early 90s, and over 160 nations acceded to that. And it said, not only will we not use weapons, which was what the previous said, it said we won't have them and we won't produce them. And then it set up a timeline for all of us that had these weapons, including the United States, to destroy them. But 167 nations is practically the entire United Nations. It's only over 190 nations that are in it. So almost all the world is against chemical weapons. And in fact, today there's only four nations that haven't acceded to it: Israel, South Sudan, North Korea, and Egypt. So it's a very small number. And at the time in 2012, Syrians had not acceded to that, and they had this large stockpile. And the reason was for deterrence. They were afraid of others attacking them. And this was their crown jewel thing that they were saving and keeping. And so that's the first thing to understand. The second thing is there was a thing called the Threat Reduction Committee that worked under the Secretary of Defense and did advisory to the Secretary of Defense about how to counter weapons destruction. And you could think of it as senior statesmen of this community that were on there. It was headed up by Gary Hart. And I ended up going to a meeting that was held in the Pentagon by this committee representing the director. And they turned to me at the end of the meeting. They said, what if we got into Syria and we found ourselves standing in front of the stockpile? What would we do? Because we found ourselves standing in front of the Iraqi stockpile after we got in there and we had no plan and it was not very well done. And so we ought to have a plan this time. And I knew from looking at the war plans and the limited time I'd been there, there was no plan. And in fact, there was no capability to destroy that much chemical weapon. We had nothing. So when you think about it, our goal at this point in time becomes open decision space, because there's no decision to be made right now. We can't do a thing.
Right.
And so we went about the task of saying, if I was standing in front of it, what would I use? And we found these experts up at the Army's at Edgewood, Aberdeen, Maryland, the Chemical Biological Center, that are in the business of destroying the chemical weapons. And we went there and talked to them about how they would do it. And they said, the only way to destroy that much weapon in liquid form is through a process called hydrolysis. Mm-hmm. And that's where you mix two chemicals together. And the resulting chemical that comes out is a new compound that can't ever be turned back into a chemical weapon. It's not a chemical. It's going to be nasty. You don't want to drink it for lunch. It's going to be acidic and terrible, but it will not be a chemical weapon.
Wear gloves, use a hazmat suit. So you add one chemical to the existing chemical and it becomes this compound, which can't be turned back into something that's a weapon. Is that right?
That's right. And to do it, typically it's a caustic thing. It's bleach water, frankly, is the thing you add to it. But you have to add 10 times the amount of water, bleach water, to the thing. So if you have a cup, you're adding 10 cups to it, you end up with 11 cups.
So since we're talking about, like I said, over 3 million pounds, you got to add 30 million pounds of bleach water?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. And is it the same? Maybe we have to go back to answer this. Are all the Syrian chemical weapons the same? I know they had mustard gas, or maybe what we call mustard gas, and phosphorus. Are they all the same? And is it the same treatment to neutralize all of them?
It's very similar treatment to neutralize them, but they didn't have the same thing. So at the end we felt it was 1,200 metric tons. 600 metric tons were of two classes of chemical weapon. They were either mustard agent, which if it gets on your skin, it blisters, but worse is if it gets in your eyes, you're going to be blind. If it gets in your throat and lungs, you're going to asphyxiate because it's going to burn your lungs apart. And then the other was sarin gas, which is a nerve gas. It's like bug spray for humans. It was developed solely to kill other humans. It causes all your nervous system to be attacked. You're going to twitch.
And just a little bit of it will do that, right?
Yeah, just a little bit. And it's hard to say. I know we're talking big numbers, but there are a lot of factors that go into how deadly it would be, the weather conditions, the wind, how much you got on you. But suffice it to say, it's a very dangerous compound, and it kills rather indiscriminately.
Are these stored by the Syrians in tanks, in barrels, safely?
That's a really good question, because as we go through this process, it unfolds. It's a series of problems that we have to solve. And one of them that I use as an example is one of the small problems is, well, how are they storing them? We, from our intelligence, really have no idea what we're getting into as to how they're storing them. Now, when we first start to see, they do store them in tanks, but they're custom-made tanks. And if you think about it, most of it isn't stored in a form of a chemical weapon. It's the last step. So it's called the precursors. So they're going to mix the last two chemicals together inside the shell or inside the bomb to create the mixture that's going to perform the way they want it to. But they're going to keep them separate just to keep it somewhat safe up until the time they're going to use them. So they store them in basically 55-gallon drums that are up on steel legs, because they want to put a valve in the bottom and bring something up underneath it and let gravity fill the bomb or the shell. It's very ingenious, right? If you're going to go through this process to set it up that way. The problem for us becomes the thing is too tall to fit in a standard ISO container like you see on the container ships. And the valves themselves, some of them are old and leaky. And so we've now got to transport in the end out of Syria these tanks. And so we have to have the Syrians like cut them off with welding torches, acetylene torches, and they're cutting it off the live thing and then repack them in these ISO containers, the standards configuration, wrap them in armored plating so no one can shoot them or damage them on the way out, and then move them out in trucks to a port for us, the Danes, to pick up.
Now, are you in Syria at any part of this process, or are your people just reporting back to you?
No. So I should describe that a little bit. So I get the first task, and then we develop over the next 6 months the field deployable hydrol system. And now we're not doing anything. Like we still don't know how we get the hydrolysis system to the chemicals, or how we get the chemicals to the hydrolysis system. And it's a stalemate.
Right.
And we didn't know, are we going to go into Syria and have to be protected and go to the sites? Are we going to have the chemicals come to us outside of Syria, perhaps in some neighboring country, and we're going to have to do that there? Or are we going to put these on planes or trains or ships and move it to yet another place where that we join up with the hydrolysis system? So when they're developing this system, they don't know how it's going to be used.
Right.
Now, what happens is Assad uses these chemicals in August. And suddenly, because President Obama had put a red line and said, if they use chemical weapons against this uprising, we will intervene. Well, naturally, President Obama and our nation don't want to intervene in another war in the Middle East. And the Russians, who are very close allies of the Syrians, do not want us intervening in Syria. They want to keep us out. Suddenly what happens is we, the United States delegation and a Russian delegation, meet in Geneva, Switzerland. And they negotiate over 3 days the plan to destroy Syrian chemicals. Now, no Syrians are even present. But we show them the hydrolysis system. We explain to the Russians how this could be done. At the end of the first day, the Russian says, yeah, this plan will work. Now, we don't have any details.
So you and your team essentially become the hinge, the keystone in avoiding an international war.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, put simply.
And you convincing them that we can do it is essential to the Russians buying it, the Russians telling their client state to back off. Basically, there is an off-ramp to this procedure, and you and your team have built the off-ramp.
Us with the people at Edgewood that are the experts, right? We've built this off-ramp.
Right.
We present it to them. They say the off-ramp looks good. Then we set up, well, what is the framework going to be for how the Syrians move their chemicals out? And they immediately accede to the chemical weapons convention.
Mm-hmm. Right. What did the people report back to you? I'm just kind of interested. The scientists or soldiers or the people who knew something about the chemical weapons program, how did they strike the Americans or anyone who had any interaction with them? Were they guys doing their job? Were they gung-ho? Were they killers? Did they know what they were handling here?
Yeah, so that's an interesting story. I sent Janelle McCauley over to The Hague 2 weeks later, where the Syrians now show up with their list of chemical weapons and the people that you're talking about, the general who runs the program and sort of the head scientist that understands the chemistry and what he's doing and what he's been developing and has laid it all out. And they're sitting down at the table and she's trying to learn, you know, what's the size of the containers and how much is it? Where is it? What's it located? And who's going to do what, right? The OPC. She says the main thing she remembers from that whole meeting and the whole several days of talking with this Syrian was the person who was the knowledgeable scientist kind of person, manager in charge. Every time she would ask a question, he would turn to the general and look at the general. Like, can I answer this?
Right.
Because this was a super secret program that they weren't allowed to talk about. They weren't allowed to say it was the crown jewels. It's what they viewed as their deterrent to stop everyone else in the Middle East from attacking.
Yeah. And I'm going to guess that Bashar al-Assad, Syria, doesn't have robust whistleblower protection laws. So you got to get clearance before you divulge.
That's right. Yeah. And these guys, even the generals, these were the elite people in the Corps, but they were committed because they had been told by the dictator, you know, we've got to get rid of these things to keep the Americans from intervening, right? This is the only way, our only way out. So there was a great lever in the background. And at the end, when we sort of signed up to this with the Russians and the international community, the Russians, we think the whole time they're going to be part of the people doing it. We actually think some of the things we built with our cooperative threat reduction money and stuff, those facilities are what we're going to use to destroy. Right. And the Russians suddenly take a step back. Once all the executive committee, the OPCW has met and voted, everything's in place and the timelines are set, they step back and say, well, we're not doing anything. Mm-hmm. This is all for you, United States. Figure it out. And we almost felt like they were trying to set us up to fail.
Well, yeah, that's my question. Why do you think they did that? It could be that, or it could be they just wanted the, well, PR victory or United Nations victory, or they actually didn't want the war, but they didn't want to do anything to pursue that aim. What do you think that they were thinking?
That's all speculation on my part, but I think the immediacy, they didn't want us to intercede, that we'd gotten our agreement. Hey, if we can do it, fine. If we can't do it, why do they care? They don't care.
Yeah. It would only embarrass the United States.
They'll embarrass the United States. We're going to screw around this for a couple of years. We won't be able to intervene because we're trying to do it. So they got what they wanted. I'm not obviously a Russian expert or talk to any of them directly, but I think that's why.
Yeah.
And so what happens is I've got an edict that says, by the way, the question you asked earlier, no boots on the ground, no U.S. boots on the ground in Syria. Because we want to stay out of a war. If we put boots on the ground or put a ship into the port, they could attack it. And now we're sort of drawn back in, right? So the whole point was to avoid anything there. So Along the way, when we get done negotiating that the Syrians are going to destroy and they're going to pack and they're going to be watched by OPCW inspectors and the UN becomes a joint mission to protect all this. So they're the protection force inside Syria. The Syrians say, well, we have no trucks. We have no packing material. We have no connexes. If you want us to do this, you, United States or somebody, have to give us that stuff. So it starts a whole nother problem set. I've got to send people, and DITRA is able to do this because we have contracts. I mean, within the next day, 24 hours later, I have people scouring the Middle East to buy used trucks, used forklifts, used things, and start moving that in, bringing it to the Syrian border. Syrian conscript would walk out, he'd get in the truck and grind the gears all the way back to Damascus, I suppose. And that became what they did to bring everything in, including all the Connex containers, everything that was going to be used in this operation.
And now, so, they didn't want any Americans there. The last mile was done by Finns and Danes at this port in Syria.
Yes. So the getting stuff in, we just brought it to the border. And that was, you know, whoever we could hire to bring it to the border because they were driving trucks out of the used car lot. And then the OPCW would come out, pick it up and bring it back in. But when they drove out to the port of Latakia, it was a Danish ship under Admiral Mikkelsen. And he and his crew and special forces would load it onto the top of their ship. And they were the transport ship for the chemicals we were interested in. And the Finnish ship would come in and pick up the other material. And so they just went back and forth. And this continued, by the way, from January until June. Now, the deadline to have it destroyed was the end of June. The last chemicals come out the 23rd of June. And most of the chemicals got loaded on in the timeline that was established. It was this last site where the rebels were sort of around. They never really overran it and took it over, but they were all close. And there was just no way that the Syrians felt comfortable going in and starting this operation because they'd come under attack and they'd lose the chemical weapons, et cetera. So the Danes were very frustrated. There was a big push. Hey, just call it a day. We got 95%. Let's just quit, right? Let's just take the victory and go home. And our government was staunchly, we're not doing that. We're getting it all. Because even that 5% could cause a lot of problems for people. So we're not going to cave. We're going to make them go get that last bit. And so that's what ended up happening.
And so the question is, as we end this part of the interview with Jay Santee, where would the United States neutralize these weapons? There was negotiations with different countries. Albania came close to allowing the business, but ultimately balked, as befits the Balkans. Then General Santee's team was told, we're going to do it on a ship. So they found giant ships used to move entire armored divisions and outfitted them to accommodate their giant hydraulic apparatus. All that tomorrow as we continue the story of Syrian chemical decommissioning. We'll also talk about what the Israelis did in their bombing attempts to neutralize the current spate of chemical weapons. That's tomorrow on The Gist. And now the spiel. When Donald Trump says something, sometimes he means it. Sometimes he doesn't know what he's talking about. Sometimes he's flat out lying. Sometimes it's just bluster. And sometimes there really is strategic ambiguity at play. Not just the retroactive excuse that, no, he wasn't lying. There was strategic ambiguity at play. But of all his policies, the one he was most honest, forthright, and direct about just might have been his vow to undo DEI root and branch. How would he do this? The answer is, we know now, totally and without any moderation. So in this program, The Gist, I have done segment after segment over the years about claims of discrimination and racism and segments about discrimination and racism, many segments on DEI. A year ago, I hosted what was called DEI Week on the show, and then one of my guests was Northwestern School of Education's Ahmad Brown, who is a scholar in diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice. He acknowledged that there's a lot of evidence, some compiled by his mentor, that shows that DEI, as it's currently implemented, just doesn't work. He talked about an example of a car company where many employees had grown tired of DEI and initiatives.
It's not just white men, for example, who are saying, I'm feeling fatigue. It's sometimes your black employees, right? And there are different reasons sometimes But, you know, there are some black employees, some, you know, people with, you know, what I might say, what I call typically in my academic work, minoritized identities, where it's like, yeah, you know, I appreciate we have this DEI initiative. I appreciate that we're caring. But you know what? I kind of want to come here to make cars and I'm tired.
Ahmaud Brown still very much believes in DEI. In fact, he has given his life to it. But there are clearly elements of DEI that are not working. He's honest enough to admit them. I saw my job over the years as pointing out the parts that do work and the parts that don't, especially if the dysfunctional elements are being inaccurately hailed as successes. That has always driven me crazy, no matter what sector of society we're in. My principle is, on DEI, everything else, to be a fair broker, to be intellectually consistent, that's very important, and to try to lead my audience, you, to think about the issues critically and factually. So, in this way, I was one of the first people in non-conservative media to point out that calls for defunding the police were awful rhetoric and worse policy. It's June 5th, 2020, I did a spiel about that. Then I did a spiel about the time the African American Museum posted information that defined, quote, white dominant culture or whiteness to include hard work, self-reliance, and respect for authority. The Washington Post headline on what happened next was African American Museum site removes whiteness chart after criticism from Trump Jr. and conservative media. Well, I criticized it too, because I'm intellectually consistent. I'm not scared if someone wants to call me a conservative, even though I'm not. This was just a dumb idea. It was backwards. It was a damaging idea. I think it was wrong for the Smithsonian to advocate it. I said so. A lot of listeners didn't like that. Then we get to police shootings, which I've done many, many, many segments on. Roland Fryer and others have found that black people are no more likely to be shot by a white cop than people of other races. But they also found, and I reported it, they are more likely to be physically abused. I also talked to many, many different scholars who got into the nuances of the issue, the non-fatal physical abuse that young black men face by cops, and also the fact that black women are more often verbally abused by cops. And that's according to a guy named Rashawn Ray, a sociologist who had a lab at the University of Maryland where he did virtual simulations. I've done dozens and dozens of stories about racism, sometimes saying this accusation of racism was overblown, many times saying, wow, this is really bad. I did segments on the exclusion of black jurors in southern courts, which was statistically significant. I did many stories on the black-white wealth gap. And my point is, I didn't and don't consider my analysis of race and DEI as conservative or liberal or moderate. It's just fact-based. It's just driven by evidence. I want to give you the evidence. And I point out often, sometimes to the consternation of listeners, I don't want to dwell on that, but every time, for instance, I talked about that Smithsonian Museum, I got so many letters and emails saying, why are you focusing on this? And isn't there something to be said? And aren't you joining with the wrong side or making a big deal out of nothing? And, you know, I just go where my interest and the facts take me. I would say more often than not, the people who listen or have continued listening appreciate that. You know, as a thesis, diversity and inclusion, they really are worthy goals. But the way that corporations and colleges implement strategies and rules to achieve diversity and inclusion, often illogical, often counterproductive, if what you really care about is diversity and inclusion. If it doesn't work, don't you want to know that? Then came the Trump administration, and they swept it all away. And after they used that broom, they got out the dustbuster, and after that, the vacuum, and then basically the gasoline and the match. So we had the worst air disaster in the U.S. in two decades. And what was the lead?
As federal investigators hunt for answers in the deadly plane crash over the Potomac River, President Trump shifts to blaming diversity policies, air traffic controllers, and his political rivals.
I put safety first. Obama, Biden, and the Democrats put policy first.
We can only accept the best and the brightest.
The era of DEI is gone at the Defense Department.
And the This Week panel segment this week on ABC was entirely given over to the question of whether Donald Trump should have blamed DEI.
Thanks. Let's get more on this now from former DNC chair Donna Brazile, former RNC chair and Trump White House chief of staff Ryan Priebus. Thank you both for joining us this morning. Donna, let me begin with you. That call from President Trump blaming the crash perhaps on diversity initiatives was echoed by other members of his cabinet. Your reaction?
Well, as you well know, George.
Now, the Gist also covered Trump's blaming of DEI hires. I focused on Trump laying the blame at the feet or foot of certain groups.
Hearing, vision, missing extremities, partial paralysis, complete paralysis, epilepsy, severe intellectual disability, psychiatric disability, and dwarfism all qualify.
But of course, this wasn't Trump just being totally idiotic. There is an animal cunning to his methods. He set a sort of trap of blaming DEI, yes, without any evidence, as all the news pointed out. But he's the president. He did have some evidence. Not that DEI had any role in the crash, but he knew that the deceased pilot was, I don't think a DEI hire, but she was Rebecca Loback. She was the co-pilot of the Black Hawk, and she was female, and she had been a White House military social aide in the Biden administration, and that is all Trump needed. He knew what he was doing, and his base, his immoderate, unreasonable base on the issue, his not guided by evidence base, as I've always tried to be, they'll love this story. They'll feel justified. And they are feeling justified now when they hear blowback that was almost guaranteed to result from his stupid application of an anti-DEI explanation for a plane crash. Here was Van Latham on the Higher Learning podcast.
And we say that DEI is the new N-word.
Yeah.
It's not the new N-word. It's worse than the N-word.
Yeah, sure it is. That's why Donald Trump says DEI, DEI, DEI at the drop of a hat or a Blackhawk. But there are at best rumors of him once saying the N-word, and they're secreted away in the vaults of the Apprentice's office, kept under guard under the assumption that even with all of Trump's transgressions, that would be an utterance too far. Because those two initials or those three letters versus that one letter, of course, they're the same thing now. I can't say that I'm surprised that the Trump administration would interpret the public sentiment that pro-DEI initiatives have gone too far, that they'd interpret that to mean, now we got to roll things back to 1965. Now we got to report on our co-workers. Now we got to blame DEI like McCarthy once blamed communists or like the Taliban blames infidels. I also wish that I could say that what the Trump administration is doing is a strategic mistake. Right? To the extent that the president had a mandate, it was only to correct excesses, not to substitute fact-free pro-DEI assertions with free-floating anti-DEI blame. But you know what? I can't say that. The American electorate is not exquisitely attuned to all the nuance of what assertions are right and what is wrong, nor can they be expected to be. The presidency, or the bully pulpit portion thereof, is a blunt instrument. It's mostly, I'm with you, and they're with them, and sometimes that's the best they can do. And now a lot of people who liked his DEI stance, it's not even registering to them what he's doing. That would be the explanation, by the way, that I prefer, that reasonable, caring people will recognize that the DEI regime went too far, that things like white privilege and white fragility and whiteness studies started sounding like unfalsifiable criticisms of immutable characteristics, and that the reasonable, caring people began to nod along in recent years and wanted the correction, wanted the pendulum to swing a little bit. But I just am not confident that the reasonable, caring people caucus is big enough to matter. When the opposite of a truly dumb and thoughtless presidential statement, which blames diversity for deaths, is countered with blaming anything on DEI is now the same as using the N, sorry, worse than the N-word. What's the reasonable, moderate stance on all that? There is a cultural pendulum, and then there's power. And more, I think everything comes down to who could grab power and how they wield it. If I tell you that Christopher Rufo and the authors of the Extreme DEI Reset have overreached and will surely face a correction, I'd say that's probably a fiction that I would use to comfort myself. It's probably more fictional than an accurate prediction of what's to come. To break through, Someone has to show how their version of a reasonable application of DEI doesn't put most people on the defensive, doesn't alienate or accuse most people, and actually strikes most people as beneficial, as improving lives. Because that's what we want government programs to do, not to act as a cudgel wielded by whoever has the power to smack down the last person who wielded that cudgel against their own enemies. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara, Joel Patterson, the Quaint Mallards, produced The Gist. Michelle Pesca's CBSO, and Leo Baum's the intern. Umpru, Gpru, Dupru. Thanks for listening.